encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Busby Babe podcast. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined by Polly Questel today. And we have a special guest with us, Aaron Lerner, the site manager of The Short Fuse, covering Arsenal for SB Nation. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be on and chat about Arsenal Manchester United ahead of a big one this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, what, five wins now straight to start the season for Arsenal?
Yeah, it is. The first time since 2004, 2005, they've won their first five in the Premier League. You guys might remember that season, actually. That was the one after the Invincibles, and Arsenal carried their unbeaten streak all the way up until playing Manchester United, and then there were some, we'll call them shenanigans, and Arsenal streak snapped. So,
yeah, that that Ruud van Nistelrooy celebration after the penalty is kind of like seared into my brain, like the image of the lasting image of van Nistelrooy for us. Was that the Battle of the Buffet? I'm not that where the
guys
threw the pizza.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all right, though. We've got Bodo Glimt in the Europa League, coached by none other than Ruud van Nistelrooy. Oh, no, sorry. It's not Bodo Glimt. It's the PSV. Other club in there. Yeah, it's PSV. PSV also in Arsenal's Europa League group, coached by Ruud van Nistelrooy. So we remember, and hopefully, you know, we can maybe unexpectedly help them get bounced from the group stage. No. Football fans and their long memories, right?
Yeah, I mean the glory days, especially for United and Arsenal, feeling pretty far away over the last couple of years.
Right, you can't call United Arsenal a big match if you don't have a long memory.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true. It has the shine's been off of that fixture for a little while, but maybe we'll bring it back.
Yeah, I mean that's
well,
the hope.
Now the problem is. We're in this stage of only one team's been half decent at the same time. And now as soon as Arsenal got good, United are maybe half decent. But that's a big maybe.
Let's go with work in progress.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think maybe if things are going well, then the reverse fixture this season will be a big one.
Yeah. Manchester United, might need to do what Arsenal did and just
okay. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to talk to you about this.
Yeah,
I don't think it's possible. I was speaking to somebody, to a friend, not even an Arsenal fan, a few weeks ago, and I just don't think it's possible to do what Arsenal did in that they just shut everybody out. And I'm not really on the Arsenal online. You know, we see it because AFTV is big and we have friends that are Arsenal fans, and it's but I definitely wasn't aware of how big it is. But I imagine that the fans got, over the last 3 years, about Mikel Arteta, they got very loud one way or the other as Arsenal were just not winning, and I don't know how much progress they seem to be making. Last year they seemed to take a step forward, but it was clear they weren't taking a massive step forward unless they did something this summer, which at that point, the way that the club had been run, you might not have had a lot of faith that they would do it. It turns out that they actually did do it, and the proof's in the pudding. It's early, but they've won five in a row to start. But the way that Arsenal really just completely shut everything out and just said, screw it, like eighth place is fine. We have our guy, and whatever it takes, we're gonna stand behind him on. How difficult was that for 3 years? How loud was the criticism getting, and how Like, did it become a toxic situation? Did it perhaps make supporting the club make you love it a little less? Like, how was it over those 3 years?
So I think you have to dial it back, honestly, to post to Arsene Wenger sort of being pushed out. They tried to do the rebuild on the fly, spend on older guys to keep it going with Unai Emery, and that just didn't work. And also, Unai Emery just wasn't the right fit. It was always going to be difficult to follow Arsene Wenger, just like it was difficult to replace Sir Alex. So you have to go back to there. Unai Emery didn't work. The squad's sort of a mess. It's got a bunch of older players, overpaid players, and they needed a reset. And that's what Mikel Arteta came in selling to the Arsenal hierarchy, that, you know, they didn't really say it in the media as much, but there were some like me who sort of kind of realized it was going to get worse before it got better. That it needed to be a clear out and a refresh. And yeah, I think that you were correct that there were definitely segments of the fan base, I don't think so much inside the club, but outside the club, that, you know, demanded immediate results. And then when they didn't come, they were getting testy. I think there was also a segment that sort of understood that it needed to be a full-on rebuild. Yeah, last season, even with Aubameyang for the first half of the season and Lacazette for the entire season, and Granit Xhaka, who's still there but also old, even with those guys in the fold, they had the youngest average starting lineup in the Premier League, and they have it again this year. You know, so there were a lot of people, and it started last year, who got behind that, who built a connection with rebuilt a connection with the club through the young players like Bukayo Saka, like Aaron Ramsdale, who's, you know, got this great energy, great smile, loves to banter with the opposing fans behind him. And, you know, it's an energy and a positivity that makes it really easy to support this bunch. Whereas, you know, it probably was a little bit more difficult to support some of the Unai Emery teams that really didn't seem to have an identity. Arsenal have an identity. You know, it's Mikel Arteta's vision. It's these young players, and, you know, it's working.
Yeah. I was very skeptical of him. I was one of the people laughing at him for a year or so. And then it was last year where I was like, oh, this guy's onto something. And they had the patience to give it to him. The Athletic wrote this article last year, 2 years ago, at some point, yeah, probably during the COVID year, that when Arsenal were really looking like still a mess, and it was just about how they knew when Arsene Wenger was going to leave, they knew they were dealing with a Sir Alex situation, and they had this advantage of looking at all the mistakes that United made and being able to say, we're not going to make those mistakes. And they prepped for it. And then through one reason or another, you know, somebody else got a different job, somebody else left the club. But like all those things that they did to prepare were a year later were gone. And somehow they came out even better on the other side. And I just, United needs to do the same thing. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was on his way to doing that in 2019-20. He had the youngest starting 11 in the league. And, you know, they got rid of Alexis Sanchez, Romelu Lukaku. They didn't sign players to replace them. They just went, we're going to go with young guys. But the club is, to me, the club is too online. They're too aware of all the criticism that comes away. They're too aware of how loud the fans are. And, you know, United have 100 million fans. If it's just 7 million of them that are being loud and dissenting, that's a very small percentage. But 7 million people is a very much large amount of people. And they I don't see them having the patience to be able to do it. They can't sign an Aaron Ramsdale. Aaron Ramsdale, he came from Bournemouth, right?
Sheffield.
Bournemouth, Sheffield. Then Sheffield, then Arsenal. Yeah.
I mean, United, they're doing it with Martin Dubravka right now, and look at the reaction. It's how the hell are you signing this goalkeeper from nowhere? And they need the behind everything. Otherwise, everyone complains. And I think if United finished eighth, they would lose faith in the manager right away and give up on that project.
I think that's part of the like mindset of the fan base as well as the club, that they don't necessarily look at these things pragmatically. They look at these things through the lens of, it's like the Twitter joke now that this is Manchester United we're talking about, where there's just not this humility to accept the situation for what it is and, give yourself the time to try and work through all of that. I mean, some of the signings that Arsenal have made over the last couple of summers are interesting to me, because I know that obviously the Arsenal fan base views Stan Kroenke in a similar way, especially after the Super League, that United fans view the Glazers. But Aaron, would you say that kind of extends to some of the club officials and the board in the same way that it does for Manchester United fans?
No, I don't think so. And I think, winning cures everything, and to a lesser extent, spending cures everything. And, the biggest knock on Stan Kroenke was that people thought that he was miserly, that he didn't really want to spend, that Arsenal were not something that he cared about. It was just some place for him to park his money. And, to an extent, that still is the case. It's the case with everybody who owns a football club. You own it because it is a valuable asset that is going to appreciate, over the years. But the Kroenkes have started spending. They spent the most of any club last summer. They backed that up with another 100 million plus in spending this summer, and are likely going to bring in another, hopefully, there's a good chance that they bring in, another 30, 40 million player before tomorrow's deadline close. So that has, I think, changed a lot of people's views on the Kroenkes, because their biggest beef with them were that they didn't spend, and that's just not the case anymore.
Yeah.
They love them, because I don't think anybody's really, other than the insane Chelsea fans and the Roman Abramovich singing, which I, don't get me started. But, most fans aren't going to love their owners until they spend and until they win. And right now, that's what Arsenal are doing.
Fans only want owners who are just going to sink money into the club. If you're willing to bankrupt yourself to spend money on your football club, fans will like you. And until they don't like you, because basically every owner that does that ends up spending their money terribly, and it actually ruins themselves and their own club. But any owner who is first of all, the American owners, as Aaron said, you're stashing your money somewhere because it's a value that's going to it's going to appreciate in value, because it's an investment to them. They might still want to win, but that doesn't mean they're willing to sink tons of money into it. They still want to make money on this. And that's always going to be, fans are always going to hate that, because they just want a guy like Roman Abramovich, who it's a plaything for him, and he's willing to spend way more money than he's getting out of it in search of winning.
I think the point I was trying to make was, I think it goes deeper than that in terms of United's problems, because they will go on these spending splurges. It's just that it doesn't make much sense. Like, they'll spend the 60 to 70 million on Casemiro. It just seems like they looked at
highest net spend over the last decade in all of Europe.
Right. And it's not, to be fair, we make this point to the fans to make sure they don't turn on us. They're spending the club's money. This isn't the Glazers opening up their own checkbook, but still, this is it. It's like this with the Cristiano Ronaldo thing. That wasn't trusting the process. It was trying to expedite the process because they saw, this they saw the biggest, you know, sporting star in the world wanting to come to their club. They didn't think about what the ramifications of that would be in terms of actual football.
What I think when you talk about the short-sightedness, essentially, is kind of what I'm hearing here, is that you have to be able to take that longer time horizon view of things and look at, you know, there are going to be some lean years. You know, adding Casemiro makes Manchester United a better team than when they don't have him. What you have to do on the back of that is sign the right younger guys so that in a year or two, you know, when he has slowed down, as you expect a 30-year-old central midfielder to do, that they've got somebody to fill his shoes. You know, he is a great gap fill, a great bridge to something, but you have to then, you know,
but to know what the other side of that looks like.
You have to know what that something is, and you have to get that something right. And taking a step back with regards to a time horizon, I think that if you, a lot of Manchester United fans and Arsenal fans, I think they've come out of it a little bit more, but they still view the Premier League as, you know, in their mind, they might even acknowledge that there's a top six now, but they still view it as a top four where Arsenal, United are the top dogs, you know, Chelsea and Liverpool and, you know, Manchester City back way back in the Invincible era when we were talking about, they, you know, they weren't a thing, but they view it as this almost entitlement to just being at the top every year. And that's just not the reality of the Premier League anymore. You know, it's a top six where the next four, six teams down the table have a ton of money because of TV deals, have good players, and if you have an off night, they're going to take points off of you. You know, it's not the situation where, you know, Sir Alex's team or Arsene Wenger's team step out onto the pitch and they just win because that's who they are, you know, because they're just that much better. They just aren't that much better anymore.
Yeah, there's about 18 teams that if you have an off night now, they're going to take points off of you. Bournemouth might be the only team this year where you can have, United sort of had an off day against Southampton, although that was also kind of an on day. But to go back to what Aaron said, of like having that plan on the back end, the bridge of United at one point, it wasn't just, oh, spending on bad deals. And at one point they were also being like, oh, we shouldn't sign this player because this is a lot of money. And while this makes us better in the immediate term, it will ultimately end up being a bad deal. And they walked away from deals like that. The issue is they just didn't address the position. And the example I'm going to use, bad example for some, is a good example if we, you know, forget about the other things. But a few seasons ago, Thomas Partey was available on a reasonable release clause, but his wage demands were outrageous for a 27-year-old who was like good but not incredible coming out of a Diego Simeone system. It was, you don't know how he's going to adapt to this. It's really, he had two amazing games against Liverpool that everybody saw, and it was, and United were like, we're not going to pay this much money in wages, etc. And they walked away from that deal. And the issue there was they didn't get another midfielder. 2 years later, you can look at, even if we forget the other stuff, if we just focus on Thomas Partey, the footballer, he is someone who is incredibly injury prone. He is constantly not available for Arsenal. Yeah, the season after he signed for Arsenal, he went out there and bossed the midfield against United. But overall, they're paying a ton in wages to a player who isn't readily available. So United had the ability to say, like, at this point, you might say, like, is Partey worth that money? Again, forgetting that other stuff. And it's questionable. And United had the ability to walk away from things like that. But they still left the things unaddressed, which just leads to them spending £60 million
we'll just do that on Casemiro next year.
Yeah. Which in 2 years you're going to be, we're going to be asking the same thing of, okay, can Casemiro really do this week in, week out anymore? And until that mindset changes, Arsenal are going to quickly, I mean, I would say they're already there. They finished above United last season, and I think they're going to stay that way for the coming season, at the very least.
So when you were talking about buying players and having a plan and, you know, not addressing issues and whatever, one of the things that immediately jumped to mind was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Arsenal. You know, that went south in a way that I think nobody could have predicted, but he was great in that FA Cup run during the COVID summer. They signed him to a new contract, and I think that the plan was to run through that contract and, you know, everybody to shake hands, wave, smile, and part ways at the end of that. He was going to be the guy who scored goals for Arsenal last season. That didn't work out, and he ended up leaving the club. But they had a guy in place who was older, who was going to cover the position until this summer, when it was clear to everybody that they were going to buy the next striker. They were going to use Aubameyang's abilities as a, you know, a guy who is still a good Premier League player to fill a hole, to get them to where they could, you know, find a long-term replacement. While they then use the money that they didn't spend to bring in a striker behind Aubameyang on other positions of need. And I think that one of the ways that we as supporters kind of don't look at things that clubs do is, you know, they have 3-5 year time horizons on, like, how am I going to fill out the team? You know, if you asked the brain trust at Arsenal, or probably even at Manchester United or any club, what's the lineup going to be in 3 years? What's it going to be in 5 years? They'll point to the guys that are currently with the squad and say, yeah, he's going to be our center back in 3 years. He's going to be our central mid. He's going to be our keeper. This is going to be our striker. We're going to need a guy at right wing. We're going to need a guy at left back. And you sort of map out when you're going to fill in those holes and when you're going to buy those players. We don't think like that as supporters. We see immediate needs in squads and say, we have to get a starter level player in right now for that hole. And that's just not how these clubs operate. And I think once you start doing that, which is what Arsenal are doing, they're, you know, buying intelligently, buying for the future. That's how you get out of these sort of bad roster constructions that Arsenal work their way out of and that United are going to try to work their way out of.
I was going to say, I think it's very kind of you to assume that Manchester United has a brain trust.
Look, this is your podcast, not mine. So, you know, I don't want to have your loyal Busby Babe readers coming at me and coming at the short.
I think most of them feel the same way about whatever is supposed to be the brain trust at Manchester United. But Aaron, we don't want to keep you too much longer, but we probably should actually talk about the game.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Sunday.
So you guys are coming in with 5 straight wins, and the one that happened today, we're recording on a Wednesday. You guys just beat Aston Villa 2-1 and then beat Fulham 2-1 at the weekend. Both of those games felt similar to me in the sense that, I mean, Arsenal got the result in the end, and that's obviously what everyone wants when you look back on a game. But what really sticks out is how much Arsenal just kind of dominate, and especially in attack. It seems like they're always at least, you know, just 5 seconds away from maybe scoring a goal.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty fair assessment of how Arsenal have been. I'll say something to that, then I have another thing that I want to key in on, both from those two matches and the Leicester City match. Arsenal are creating a lot more chances than they did, and a lot of that has to do with the addition of Gabriel Jesus. With Alexander Lacazette in that position, or a less mature Eddie Nketiah last season, Arsenal had a guy who could check back, but then wouldn't get wouldn't be able to spin and get into the box. Nketiah, because I don't think that his sense as a striker was developed, and Lacazette because he just wasn't physically able to. Gabriel Jesus can do that. He'll come deep. He'll come wide, and then the move will progress, and he has sprinted into the box, and he's getting involved again. And that just puts so much more pressure on opposing defenses because, you know, it's more guys getting forward. It's more guys running into the box, pulling defenders out of position and creating havoc. And that's sort of what the Arsenal attack is doing really well right now. Gabriel Jesus is popping up on the wing. Martin Odegaard is flashing to the wing. Granit Xhaka is making – it's shocking to say that Granit Xhaka is making a third man run into the box. The positions are so much more fluid. There's so much more motion, and people are – and players are just – it sounds sort of simple to say, but they're running more. They're running more. They're running into the box more. And when you get bodies into the box, when you get the ball into the box – you know, it's more complicated than that, and Arsenal are doing it more skillfully. But at a very basic level, you know, when you put the ball in the box with bodies in there, good things happen. You create chances, you create chaos, and the ball winds up in the back of the net. Another thing that's different from this Arsenal team is they're resilient. They're a resilient, scrappy bunch. You know, the knock for years on Arsenal, they don't like it up them. You know, they fold when things don't go their way. Twice against Leicester, way back earlier in the season, we're five games in, but twice against Leicester, Leicester scored and Arsenal scored within the next 5 minutes. They scrapped out a win against Fulham with a Fergie time goal. Aston Villa equalized in the second half today, and Arsenal scored 2 minutes later. You know, they bounce back in a way that we haven't seen, previous Arsenal teams do. I hate breaking things down to mentality and all of those sort of soft factors, but, you know, it's hard to deny as someone who has watched the team for years and years that, you know, these guys play harder. They fight, you know, there's something in the mentality, in the mindset, they have more resolve than they have had in the past. And it's a lot of fun to watch.
And it's different too, because this wasn't just something that was like, it seemed like it was a problem under Unai Emery. It seemed like it was something that had just kind of set into Arsenal's identity that, you know, even on the later years under Arsene Wenger, they were going to be a team that looked really pretty and played really nice passes and scored some beautiful goals, but in the end you could still beat them. And maybe they weren't reliable enough to go and win things, even though, I mean, that obviously wasn't the case because they kept winning cups pretty consistently over the 2010s. Do you think that kind of mindset change is something that the World Cup is going to have an impact on, of, you know, if they can continue this really good run of form, what's the possibility of that big break being a derailment? Because it seems like you mentioned before we started recording, that this was something that sort of started in preseason.
Yes. I mean, it's tough to tell just because everybody's going to have the break, you know. You don't want to be on a great streak of momentum and then have everybody go off and, yeah, then come back, because you can lose it. But at the same time, you know, all of the good teams are going to have some key players go to the World Cup, but that means that the rest of the squads are going to be able to rest and recover. And, you know, already that's something that Arsenal seems like they need heading into Sunday. You know, Zinchenko is questionable, hopefully able to play. He trained on Tuesday and should probably be available. But Thomas Partey is out for a couple weeks. Martin Odegaard was on the receiving end of a not-so-nice tackle from John McGinn and had to leave. Continued playing, but 5-10 minutes later had to come off. Mo Elneny, who is not a starter, but is the go-to cover for Thomas Partey, looks like he'll be out longer term. So already Arsenal have some some midfield injury questions that, you know, they could use a little bit of rest. And, you know, so circling back to your question, that World Cup could provide them the rest that they need, you know, for the guys who don't go to the World Cup. But, you know, I'm a little bit more focused on who might not be available on Sunday, you know, because.
Right.
So one of the big innovations or changes before Zinchenko was knocked out of the lineup was that Arsenal started playing in that 2-3-5 basically in possession, where both of the wingbacks tuck in next to a lone holding midfielder, which was Thomas Partey. And then he would have Zinchenko on one side and Ben White on the other to form almost a midfield three with five attackers in front. Zinchenko being out and replaced by Kieran Tierney, who is undoubtedly a better defender than Zinchenko is, but does not have nearly the abilities on the ball that Zinchenko does, sort of affects that ball progression, that ball retention in the midfield, and changes the way Arsenal want to play. So if Zinchenko's back, you'll probably see a little bit more of that. But, you know, missing Partey, missing Zinchenko hurts Arsenal's ball progression and ball retention. And, you know, that's something that could prove to be an issue, especially, you know, against a better Manchester United team. I'll point out that I don't know how playing Villa affected it, although I don't think that it affected it much. But Arsenal had the easiest first four games of the Premier League season. And, you know, Aston Villa have 3 points from their first five, so they're not much better. You know, Manchester United are a better team than Arsenal have faced. And that, you know. No, they are. They're better than what Arsenal have played so far. You know, so that could be, you know, that could be an issue.
I think, at least I'm expecting Arsenal to have more of the possession just based on how they're playing right now and the way that they want to play. And looking at Erik ten Hag's Manchester United so far, you know, it worked out okay in the Liverpool game with the 11 that went out. And, you know, it seemed like there was something a little extra that day that gave them the edge. But this is a team that's not ready to play the way that Erik ten Hag wants. And that is, at least for me, going game to game, leaves me a little bit uneasy in terms of ways he's viewing matchups, ways he's trying to be pragmatic about things, ways he's still trying to implement what he wants to do and make a more possession-based side. And I'm kind of thinking that against Arsenal, he's going to have to set up in a similar way to kind of absorb pressure and counterattack, or try and, you know, get an early lead and then set back.
Yeah. And again, we'll circle back to Odegaard's potential availability. I'm watching Twitter as we speak, and it may only be just a knock, might not end up being something that keeps him out. But, you know, him being not at 100% is especially problematic if ten Hag sets United up in a little bit of a deeper block, because Odegaard's vision, creativity, and passing is sort of one of the ways that Arsenal would unlock a low block. I think that, you know, against a team that sets up to try and play a little bit more expansively, missing Odegaard or having him not at full speed isn't as much of a loss, because Arsenal can, you know, be successful with Martinelli and Saka from wide areas, their ability to, you know, run with the ball, to beat guys on the dribble. But if, you know, if you're looking at 9-10 defenders in front of you, you need a guy who's really going to be able to pick that pass, and that's Odegaard.
How susceptible are Arsenal to a counter-attacking side? They, you know, Arteta has some similarities to Pep, and that's one of that's notoriously been one of the kryptonites of Guardiola's system.
It's honestly tough to say.
They have tactically in the past and not let them counterattack on them.
Tactically, you're right, and Arsenal are playing in a similar way in possession to Pep Guardiola's Manchester City side, although we won't get into the sophistication of the tactics. There are some specific differences that some people, smarter tactical folk than I, have written about that are interesting to look into between subtle differences in how the two managers set their teams up. The answer is we don't really know how susceptible Arsenal are to counterattacks because, you know, this is the first season that we've really seen the 2-3-5 in possession in action. Arsenal really didn't play like that pretty much at all last season because they didn't have the personnel to set up like that. And so from a pragmatic standpoint, Arteta didn't send them out to play like that. So they could be vulnerable that way. Absolutely. You know, it'll be a big test for William Saliba, who was bought by Arsenal way back under Unai Emery, spent 2 years on loan in France. There was a whole hullabaloo on Arsenal side of the internet about, you know, oh, does he want to be at the club? Are they mishandling him? Whatever. And he has been absolutely excellent as a center back for the opening five games of the season. You know, so it'll be another test for him to see how he stacks up to, you know, some of the individual quality that Manchester United will be throwing at him. But he's been really good, and I'll be interested to see how he stacks up and keep an eye on him, because he looks to be a really good player. But yeah, I mean, to go back to your question, Arsenal might be vulnerable on the counter. We will find out if that's how Ten Hag sets up and, you know, Arsenal play as we expect them to do. You know, we'll see.
I think if he sets up too deep, United are in trouble.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on how Leicester goes, because this still isn't a team that we've really seen how they look when Casemiro is playing instead of McTominay. We've seen that Christian Eriksen looks pretty useful as the other part of that pivot, but this is also a guy who has started every Manchester United game so far this season, and by the 50-60 minute mark, he looks absolutely gassed.
It's getting earlier every game because he's already gassed. We're four games into the season and he's gassed. We're playing Thursday. Put that on the record. Arsenal played Wednesday and we're playing Thursday. Not complaining about the schedule, just pointing it out. We're playing Thursday. We have the quick turnaround to Sunday. If you're going to run back Christian Eriksen twice in that span, you're asking for trouble. They've won two games. They put the same 11 out in both games. And to a certain degree, they were lucky to win both games. And Christian Eriksen played twice. Rafael Varane, if you play him twice in 4 days, you're asking for some part of his glass body to break. It's going to be interesting to see how they approach this game.
Yeah, well, and you talk about Eriksen getting gassed. You know, Arsenal, especially with Gabriel Jesus and Martin Odegaard, and to a lesser extent, Martinelli and Bukayo Saka, they chip in as well. But the Arsenal press, you know, those four forwards that I just named, they do not give opposing defenders and midfielders a lot of time on the ball.
Well, news is that we don't play out from the back anymore. We just hope.
Well, we might see a lot of that then, because, you know, if their first instinct is to just hoof it when they come under pressure, they're going to be hoofing it a lot, because Gabriel Jesus is relentless in his energy in chasing down defenders. Gabriel Martinelli has a really high work rate. Martin Odegaard presses very intelligently. And Bukayo Saka actually had a great piece of pressing just in the match today. He does the same. So, you know, it could be a lot of Manchester United hoofing it out, Arsenal's defenders collecting it, you know, and progressing it right back up the field.
Do you have a score prediction in mind?
I don't know. I hate to say 2-1 to Arsenal, because that's what we've had our last few score lines, but I think 2-1 or 3-1 to Arsenal seems about right. I'll give you a little stat that might help you guys out. Bukayo Saka has not scored from open play in something like 15 consecutive Premier League matches now. he forced an own goal against Crystal Palace that, you know, might have been able to be credited to him. He assisted Gabriel Martinelli on the winner today. He's getting involved. I'm not as worried about him as some people seem to be, although it's kind of like, eh, when's he going to wake up? When's he going to do something? But, you know, he missed basically a sitter against Aston Villa and then also failed to knock it in on a goal mouth scramble. Arsenal had a couple others like that against Aston Villa and, you know, didn't put away chances against Fulham. You know, there's a world where we've seen this script in Arsenal Manchester United before, where Arsenal dominate the game, don't put away chances. David De Gea makes a couple good saves and Manchester United, you know, steal a point or get the win, because as well as Arsenal are playing and dominating matches, you know, they're not humming along scoring like you saw, you know, like we're seeing from Manchester City now. And like we saw last season from City and Liverpool, you know, they're not at that level yet. The next step in their evolution is really to capitalize and make the score lines of their matches reflect the sort of dominance that they have territorially and in terms of chances. But, you know, so I'll say 3-1 to Arsenal, but, you know, it's Manchester United at, you never know what can happen.
This is not the same David De Gea that played that. The game you're thinking of, it is not the same David De Gea at all. True. I'm like, yes, yes, that was an all-time performance that like never could get replicated. So in theory, like, know. Yeah, it could come know. Out of maybe, nowhere, but he was in great form. He was in great form heading into that.
Maybe I've just got some David De Gea trauma. I know he's got it in him.
I actually wrote to someone from Arsenal. I forget even who it was, but asked me a bunch of questions that I filled out. And my score prediction was 2-1 to Arsenal. And now the more I think about it, I don't know where United are finding that goal. If they're just hoofing it deep, like, yeah, Antony is going to come into the team. Probably, but assuming that they sign him, they've not signed him yet.
He still needs to get his visa processed.
Right. So let's
something wacky will happen. Arsenal, Arsenal have given up what, 4 or 5 goals this season. At least 2 of them you could basically say were gifts. So, you know, that's almost half the goals they've conceded were mistakes or gifts given to the other team. So, you know, it's entirely possible that Manchester United goal that we're talking about comes from an Arsenal gift.
We've seen United.
You can see the scars on this Arsenal fan just from years of.
we've seen United have good forwards against Arsenal before and not have midfielders.
Oh man, do you guys have any young attackers that you're giving a debut to so that, you know, we can have another Marcus Rashford debut against Arsenal or Anthony Martial debut against Arsenal? You know,
we should bring in Alejandro Garnacho,
The Marcus Rashford debut is definitely one of the funniest games of all time. That was a team of God only knows who against an Arsenal team that were like pushing for a title. And they just wiped the floor.
Some kid's going to come in and just, you know, come on in the 65th minute, score a brace by the 75th. God.
That just doesn't seem to happen anymore, though. So, like, Ronaldo scored at the Emirates last year. They didn't score the year. Yeah, when was the last time? United have scored one goal in the last 3 seasons at the Emirates?
Well, all the more reason that they're going to pot like 3 then.
Well, this one's at Old Trafford, though, right?
Yeah.
Which aren't much better.
All the more reason that, you know, the script's going to flip. That's one of the things that, you know, we're working towards it as Arsenal supporters, that to have a little bit more confidence in this team. You know, I'm sitting there at 1-0 up, and it's like, oh God, Villa are going to score. And they did. And then at 2-1 up, you know, you feel like, oh, it's going to happen again. You're waiting for it to happen. And then it doesn't, you know. It was 1-1 against Fulham until Arsenal scored at the death. You know, they're doing the thing so far this season. And, you know, maybe it's time that we start believing that they're going to do the thing. That is not, you know, I'm not saying win the league. They're not going to win the league. But, you know, the results that, you know, we sort of have these scars that, you know, it's not going to go our way. Maybe some of them will start going our way.
Yeah, start playing in Europe on Wednesdays and Tuesdays instead of on Thursdays.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That's the goal this season.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Aaron. I know you said you've got to go, so we don't want to keep you too much longer, but we really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun, and best of luck on Sunday, I guess. Hopefully we get a good game.
Hopefully everyone has fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Both teams played hard. Both teams had fun. All right, take it easy, guys. Thanks so much.
All right. See you, Aaron.
Bye.
Thank you.
So, Polly, what were your takeaways from the 1-0 win at Southampton, other than maybe trotting out the 11 just because it won isn't the best idea?
I don't think that's what cost them that was an issue against Southampton. It was very obvious right from the jump that, again, it was just we're playing with the same tactics of, like, just get rid of the ball. Just get rid of it and worry about it later. Southampton were not good at all, and that's – United were strong beneficiaries of that. And I know that their performance against – their result against Chelsea is going to flatter that performance. But let's put it this way. Southampton's last two matches against Manchester United, they had an XG of 1.6 to an per FREF and StatsBomb, and an expected goals against of 1.1. They lost 1-0. And then against Chelsea, they had an expected goals of 0.8 and an expected goals against of 1.2. And they won 2-1. And that's football. That happens sometimes. And that's kind of what happened against United. United, of that one, of the 1.1 XG that United had, two-thirds of it came in the 18th minute on that flurry of chances where Bruno had the header, Ilunga had the rebound, Bruno had a rebound, Eriksen had a rebound. That accounted for two-thirds of their creation. They didn't create any other chances except for the Bruno goal. They weren't good. And like if they were playing a better team, because Southampton were really bad, and they seemed to lack that ruthlessness and sharpness in front of goal. If they're playing a better team, like if they would have done that against a Brighton or a Brentford, they would have lost, just like they did lose to Brighton or Brentford.
I think it's worth mentioning too that goal came, there's like that, it's like a 10 minute period coming out of the half where it looked like United were a bit sharper, they were sticking to the game plan and things were looking a little bit better. Anthony Elanga also had a 1-2 with Bruno that
exactly where it came from is Anthony Elanga got the ball like two or three times on the right side and turned inward and ran at players. And that's what created movement. It's what created you know, there was one where he did the 1-2. Then on the next one, it was the left back moved inside and left Diogo Dalot alone. The left back moved inside to try to stop Elanga, who then laid it off to Jadon Sancho. And by then, Diogo Dalot's left all alone and created that. So, it all came from just a couple instances like that of Elanga just running at defenders. One 10-minute stretch is not great.
We're only two chances really kind of manifest. And Elanga, it doesn't count as a chance because Elanga didn't get a shot off. But still, it was not promising. The rest of the second half after they got the goal was, you know, like you said, they should have conceded. And even, you know, the one like save that De Gea did have to make, it was sort of right at him. So Southampton really just weren't there on the day.
It was a good save, but like that's the thing, is De Gea had to make one save. And at the end of the game, so yes, obviously things are going to get skewed a little bit more when you're facing a team that are chasing the match and down by a goal. But over the last, once Ronaldo came on, so that's with 20 minutes to go, United didn't get another shot. At that point, they were outshot. How many did Southampton get at that point? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more against the team with a brittle defense. And I mean, 2 weeks, how many weeks ago was it? 3 weeks ago, we just saw a ball go right through De Gea's hands into the net. Like, he's that vulnerable for a mistake at any point. You're playing with fire, and what's scary is that they couldn't get the game under control. They mm-hmm. brought on Casemiro. They ended up bringing on Fred. Like, so you have three, you literally have your new defensive midfielder, who quickly had a player blow right by him and then slid in and missed the tackle, which was a little funny. And who'd they take? They took off Eriksen. And then you have your two high-energy number eights, and you can't get any possession towards the end of the game. You can't kill off the game. Like, that's concerning against Southampton, who...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a forward who looks like he wants to be anywhere else in the world for those 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, I mean, forgetting that for a second, just you're up one with 5 minutes left in the game, and you're bringing on your defensive midfielder guy here. You should be able to get some composure and lock it up. Whether that's, you know, possessing the game to death from there, or just not allowing Southampton to breach your box. I know that's a weird term, the way that just sounded. and to get it in and to get chances. And that's all they did. Southampton successfully entered United's penalty area more than Liverpool did. And they had way less of the ball. That's concerning.
Yeah. And I mean, we're not going to talk much about Leicester since it is happening tomorrow. So, I mean, we're not even going to have an episode to be able to process it until after the Arsenal game has happened too.
But kind of be okay against Leicester, because Leicester are in that Southampton boat of might just be so bad that a not good performance will still get the job done.
But they're also just kind of like sticking to their guns in the way that they try to play. So they've got these, you know, mostly attack-minded midfielders who like to take lots of long shots and run all over the place. But the only thing really about the Leicester match that gives me pause going into the Arsenal game is whether or not Erik ten Hag rotates, because at some point it seems like he's going to have to. I know we've said that at points under different managers, and then it didn't happen, and things went bad when it didn't happen. But, I mean, you're not going to have Antony. You got to think about what your front three is going to be like at the weekend. You got to think about what your midfield is going to look like at the weekend. But you also have to think about breaking in a player like Casemiro into a starting lineup.
And you also have to think, it's more of a concern for the year. I mean, people are going nuts over this transfer window now because Antony is coming in, and they've gotten the defensive midfielder and the right winger in the same window for the first time in... I don't know how many years, maybe since Owen Hargreaves and Nani came in the same season. But your only ball moving midfielder is this 31-year-old who doesn't seem to be able to play more than 70 minutes in a match. How's that going to hold up over a full season?
Yeah, they really have to be right about this Casemiro Fred partnership, I think. Because otherwise it's going to get ugly. Like, what's Casemiro and McTominay pivot going to look like?
I have a feeling that's going to look a lot like Matic and McTominay.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that when Casemiro came on, United did not have any control. They lost whatever control that they did have, and they started giving up shot after shot after shot.
Yeah. I mean, Casemiro's played in a team that's had control, and I mean, you know, their run to the Champions League last year was unique, but when they play in La Liga, they generally have control because he's got two of the best midfielders in the world next to him. What's he going to look like when
Best midfielders next to him, but also the quality of team. Like, just pay attention to where who's making moves in the transfer market right now. It's not just that Newcastle or Aston Villa or anybody are signing these young midfielders. You're like, why aren't, and Newcastle have money because they're Saudi Arabia, but Aston Villa are just regular old Premier League TV money. And it's not just, oh, they're signing players that United should have been in for, but look at who these players are leaving. They're leaving clubs that are in the top of these foreign leagues. They're in the European places, and they're opting to go to clubs in the bottom half of the Premier League table because there's way more money there, which means the clubs in the bottom half of the Premier League table, like Southampton would be a top half team in La Liga. They are way better than most of the Spanish teams. The drop off from the top team, like, yes, you have your, even in, even like, let's rewind 4 years to like when everybody was back to being good the way we think of them. Yeah, you have Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, and Barcelona as three of the top teams in the world. And Sevilla are routinely, you know, one of those teams in the Europa League. The rest of the teams are bottom half clubs. They're, you know, the way that the Premier League is, you're playing tough teams. As we said before with Aaron, there's like 18 teams where if you're not on your day, they're going to beat you. And you need to be able to handle that now over the course of a full season. Whereas Casemiro had so many games where they were just playing, you know, teams that weren't even good enough. You know, you find basically teams that are like a little bit better than the teams you see in the Europa League group stage.
Yeah. Maybe we should save his like full or first start for Arsenal then. Like a game under the lights.
Right. I mean, I remember when this was like a thing in the middle of the last decade, when Barcelona and Real Madrid were dominating the Champions League, but Bayern were going to the semifinals every year. They were winning the league in April. And then it was like, oh, well, now they're going to be able to rest their players every week. You can't turn the switch off and then turn it back on. So like Bayern would win the league basically like April 1st. And on the weekend, it was just next, did not matter if they won or lost. Whereas Barcelona and Real Madrid were neck and neck. So they were playing Getafe and Espanyol and name another tiny Spanish club. But the La Liga season would be decided by one or two points. So their managers could rotate players. They could, Zidane could rest Ronaldo. You know, they could do some things to rest players, but when they were playing, they had to win that game. So the intensity was still there, and it was just, we just don't need to, we're not exhausting ourselves trying to beat this club, but mentally they're still switched on in that we have to win this game. And it was so much of a, you know, that task affected them in Europe and kept them going, whereas Bayern Munich did not have that. And I think that's part of one of the things that PSG have these issues with. You'll notice, when was the last time that these guys went to the final? When they played a mini tournament during COVID. They both went to the final when they were only doing Champions League stuff, and they didn't have the midweek, you know, which is supposed to.
Your mic is cutting in and out.
I'm sorry. Casemiro played, you know, where he wins the ball back and then it's just quick little pass to either Cruz or Modric and let them settle it down. And at United, it's like, who are you giving the ball to let them settle it down? Even when United were at their best, it was like Matic would win the ball back and he'd give it to Pogba. But then teams just started double and triple teaming Paul Pogba. And that's where United would break down because who else could settle it down?
Yeah. We might be able to do a whole podcast at the end of the season on like missing Paul Pogba, but we probably shouldn't, just to save ourselves that. But all right, so I think that's going to do it for us this week. We'll be back next week after Manchester United hopefully have 6 more points, but probably not. We'll find out, and maybe Antony will be registered by then and we won't be left hanging on deadline day. Anyway, thanks for listening.